Hey, man, how's things? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate y'all tuning in today. Got a good one lined up. I think I mentioned... I forget if I explained. I woke up the other morning just thinking about, for some reason, like a song playing in my head about the Islamophobia industry and some of the great journalism that's been done about it. So it's kind of old hat. I mean, we've covered this before on the show. But Eli Clifton is really good on it. And plus, he's just a great journalist anyway. And it's becoming more and more of a problem. So, you know, I don't know, man. It's not like this show is the antidote to it or whatever, but I try to shed a little bit of context in the face of a country full of demagogues. Pretty much, as a rule of thumb, it's not perfect 100% of the time. But as a rule of thumb, if people are demagoguing against the politically powerless, the demagogues are the problem, not the politically powerless people. You know, mostly. And hell, half the time when they're demagoguing against the powerful, they're just as dangerous, as we can see with Sanders and Trump. So, anyway. Demagogues, don't like them. But, you know, especially picking on people for their religion and stuff like that. This is America, man. We all got higher principles than that, right? Yeah. The Pope today gave a speech before Congress where... You know, I don't know whether this is positive or not. He says, you know, Anakin, there are shades of gray. Not everything is black and white. Not everything is good versus evil, righteous versus sinners. So, you know, might climb at least halfway down off your high horse there, buddy. But he didn't even use the word Islam. He didn't say, hey, look, let me tell you about Islamophobia and all this demonization and demagoguery against a billion point something people in the world. Alright? It's a bunch of crap and it has to stop. How hard is that to say? Especially if you're the freaking Pope. You can't just say, all you demagoguing against Islam, don't know what you're talking about. Should be easy, but apparently it's not. You could only kind of refer to it obliquely, you know? Hey, please don't be so intolerant, okay? I'd appreciate a little bit of intolerance toward intolerance. You know? Might be nice. Anyway, so I'm sick of that crap. So, Eli Clifton, I invited him back on the show so we could talk a little bit about what's behind it all. I think you'll find it very interesting. Okay, and then, get this. I'm finally going to get a chance to interview Julian Borger. Think it's a soft G, but maybe it's a hard G. Borger, Borger. Well, he shared his contact details with me. I guess I could type him a question and ask him. Borger. I think it's a soft G. I think somebody told me that before. Yeah. All right. Anyway, Julian Borger, he's a great reporter for The Guardian. I've been reading him for a long, long time. As I mentioned yesterday, often link for years and years, I've linked back to his great piece on the neocons and how they got us into Iraq War II, the spies who pushed for war. Just kind of misnamed because the neocons are not spies. I mean, unless you count them as agents of influence for Israel, but I don't think that's what he meant. But that's in there. The spies who pushed for war. You'll want to read that. It's in The Guardian. But anyway, the reason I'm going to have him on the show is to talk about this. West ignored Russian offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside. Isn't that just about as disappointing as can be? You know, if I had feelings, I would be sad about that. It was just absolutely unconscionable. You know? It's just crazy. Anyway, I don't want to elaborate. I want to save it for the show. Here. I'll tell you what. I'm going to play you my new spot as I write up a blog entry and a tweet for today's show. Check it out, man. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. Isn't that cool? So, as it says in the spot, okay, this isn't for everyone. But anyone who needs some serious engineering done on an industrial project, which could be some of you, I hope, do me a favor. Use my guy, all right? Help support this show, MPV Engineering. And you'll be hearing a lot more of that clip. If you know anybody, I mean, this isn't just for, you know, commercial projects. This is for industrial projects. But anybody you're doing business with along those lines, pass the word along, mpvengineering.com. And that'll help to support this show if you do so. Isn't that cool? That's a good sponsor to have if you ask me. I sure hope I can drum up some business for him. All right. So, blogs blogged, tweets tweeted, show announced. Thank you guys for tuning in. Join up the chat room. Hey, guys. We got Brooklyn and Embers and Number Six and Kit and the rest of the guys. JDA's in there. Brooklyn, good to see you guys. Aqua Buddha, that better not be you, Rand. No, I'm just playing. Chat room's full of dudes. So join up and say hi, scotthorton.org/chat, scotthorton.org/chat. And you guys can chat about things or not, you know, whatever you're into. It's a IRC free no chat, hashtag Scott Horton Show, if you want to join up. Also, I got a tweeter implanted in my left eyeball here. Tweeter. Implanted right in my eyeball, so not literally, but pretty damn much. So tweet me if you want to tweet me. And that's another good way to communicate with me during the show. Sometimes I take calls, but not too often, but I probably should get back in that habit. But anyway, tons of news to cover on the show today, and a couple of great guests. As long as I was playing that new spot for you, MPV Engineering at mpvengineering.com, let me tell you about Listen and Think Audio and this great deal that Derek Sheriff is offering. We decided to tweak it up a little bit. So now it works like this. Anybody who donates $50 to the show can get the audiobook of their choice from Listen and Think Audio. And then anybody who donates $100 to the show, you get either a QR code commodity disc or you get Sheldon Richman's book, Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax, or Charles Goyette's book, Red, Blue, and Broke All Over, about the debt and the Fed. And the wars, some too. And then anybody who donates $200 to the show gets a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Audio, which is all libertarian audiobooks. And the guy's on a mission to do the audiobook of every libertarian book out there that isn't in audio format yet or that gets published from here on out. That's his mission. So there already are dozens to listen to, and there will be probably hundreds more. So any $200 donation, I know it's a lot, but for those of you who can afford it, and if you're interested in audiobooks and that's the kind of thing that you're into anyway, how could you possibly do better than a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. Go to scotthorton.org/donate for more details. And, you know, I had listeners of the show getting on me and saying, hey, man, you got to do business. At the beginning of the show, you got to remind people how they can help support the show. Oh, and this is the part I meant to say above and beyond all that stuff. You too can be like MPV Engineering and like Master Samurai Tech and the Council for the National Interest and my other great sponsors by supporting the show and advertising on the show. Just email me, scott@scotthorton.org. I way rather do business that way and not even have to ask for donations at all, but you know how it is. So email me, scott@scotthorton.org if you want to advertise. Just check out scotthorton.org/donate for more.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. Like I say, Eli Clifton and Julian Borge are coming up on the show. Tons of news to cover. Tons of bad news. At the Hodge, 717 people have been trampled to death in a giant stampede. Can you believe that? 717 people killed. At the big Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. If that ain't symbolic of what's going on in the greater so-called Islamic world right now, what a disaster. And then there's this war czar. This is a title that was invented by George Bush when he threw a temper tantrum, didn't want to have to pay attention to the Iraq war anymore. So he put, who was it? Marine General somebody in there. I forget his name now. All of a sudden escapes me. To be the war czar. So now this is, I guess, a new permanent position. You know, because this is America, a humble commercial republic with a government full of czars, which is just Russian for Caesars, which is just Roman for emperor, boss of you. Dictator, Lord. Anyway, so John Allen, he has lost the war against the Islamic State, so he's retiring. And he's let it be known that he wanted to put in more ground troops. He wanted to establish a safe zone for Al-Qaeda in Syria. And that he's just frustrated that the president won't let him do more in this war, so he's just got to go. Jason Ditz points out at news.antiwar.com, Allen had only been intended to hold the position for 6 months at any rate. Which, what the hell is that? General, you're my man to win this war for the next 6 months, and then we'll replace you. Jason says he agreed to stay on longer because the war wasn't going very well. Well, anyway, I appreciate Obama's don't escalate it worse than he already has policy, but, he's just biding his time. And he's still going to go down as the man in history who empowered the Islamic State, not by leaving Iraq, but for backing the rebellions in Libya and especially in Syria. So, I appreciate he didn't want to reinvade the place. Look, the Turks have no interest in sacking Mosul and driving out the Islamic State, sacking Raqqa and driving them out. That's not going to happen. The Iranians aren't going to do it. Send their entire army into Iraqi Sunnistan and even as far as Syria? No way. And imagine the backlash from that. So no one else but the Americans can do it, and at least under Obama, as Prothero put it, the Americans ain't coming, man. Special forces on the ground with laser pointers, that's and planes in the sky, that's one thing, but there is not going to be a reinvasion of Mosul, Ramadi, Fallujah. Which, you know, I don't know, man. Once Jeb comes, or Trump, or Hillary, then all bets are off and roll the dice all over again, man. You very well could see something like that. But at least under Obama, it's just going to be a horrible air war, the kind that Rand Paul endorses and would like to continue, he says. But anyway, so, you know, it's Nancy Youssef has been writing this stuff, and I think it's true. I mean, you could categorize it as war propaganda because it does serve the war party, but also I think it's still just right that all these rosy assessments of the strength of the Islamic State are a bunch of crap, man. And the reason I say that is, one, because of Nancy Youssef, because I take her very seriously, but also, that's what Patrick Coburn's been saying all along. 30,000? Yeah, maybe times 10. Probably more like 200,000. They're fighting here, 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 and here. That's, you know, 150,000, 200,000 guys sounds like a plausible estimate. And the Americans are playing it down. And now Nancy Youssef is reporting at the Daily Beast, which is, you know, War Propaganda Central, I admit, and her co-author on this, on a few of them, have been warmongering types. But I believe that it's true that they're fixing the intelligence around the policy in a way that we might define as, a good way. But the policy is Obama doesn't want a worse war than the one he's got, and so the intelligence is being fixed to say that the air war is working. And it could be also, maybe I'm just not cynical enough, even after all these years, that actually the policy all agreed secretly, but they just can't say it, is, like Eric Margolies said, they like the Islamic State and they want it there. They want the meanest sons of bitches in charge of Iraqi Sunnistan in order to limit the influence of Iraqi Shiistan under the domination of Iran, thanks to George W. Bush. And so they're perfectly happy to have basically bin Laden himself up there. Not just the leader of the Islamic State, but self-declared caliph. And that well could be it too. But anyway, according to Nancy Youssef, all the intelligence guys are mad as hell because every time they want to tell the truth about just how powerful the Islamic State is growing, they're told that they better go rewrite it and make it sound like the air war means a damn thing. No surprise there, but still it is what it is. All right, now what time is it? Oh man, I ain't got time. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah, here's Trump on the Iran deal here. Listen. Awful, without any question. The front runner here.
How do you intend to help protect Israel under a regime that is moving very quickly towards a nuclear bomb?
So the Iranian deal is one of the worst contracts I've ever seen of any kind. Nothing to do with countries or anything. It's the most incompetently drawn document I think I've ever seen. It's a one-way street. It's going to lead to nuclear proliferation as sure as you're sitting there. It was done by people that don't have a clue, and it's a disgrace. We don't even get our prisoners back. I mean, in all fairness, can you imagine? We have four prisoners over there, and they don't even ask them. They said, we can't do that because we don't want to complicate the deal. We're giving them back. Think of that. You'd walk in if it's you. By the way, who would you rather have negotiating, Trump or those clowns that are negotiating right now? Okay? Trump. I mean, honestly, they asked Kerry, you know, as he was recovering. The guy's in a bicycle race. He falls off a bicycle, 73 years old. He's in a race. He's got the helmet. He's got the whole deal. He's got patches. He falls off. He's our chief negotiator. He's in a bicycle race. I tell people, I promise if I'm president, I will never go into a bicycle race. I promise. You know why? I'll tell you what. I won't have time. I'll be working. I'll be working. But you know, there's a couple of clothes. First of all, the 24 days, everyone knows. But that doesn't even start, you know, the inspection period. That doesn't even start. The clock could keep it much longer than 24 days. These guys could clean up and you wouldn't know a damn thing, despite what they tell you. But there's so many elements. But one of the elements, when Tim mentions Israel, there's sort of a clause in there that nobody's really understanding, that if Iran gets attacked, we have to help them. Now you say, what if Israel attacks them? Are we supposed to be fighting Israel? This is the most incompetent agreement.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, the Trump clip there. I just thought that was funny. You know, he was previously asked, so, you know, where do you get your foreign policy knowledge and what do you know? What do you think should be done? And he said, well, I watch the shows, you know, like the Sunday morning news shows. That's all. That was it. I think he said, I like John Bolton. Now, there's a guy who seems like he knows what he's talking about. Oh, God. Yes, he does seem like that, I guess. Confident in his own position, no doubt about that, yeah. And then so here, the guy, this idiot, asks him, oh, the deal is so horrible, so horrible. What are we going to do to protect Israel? No pretension of caring about America's interests whatsoever. Israel first. That's all that's left of conservatism in America now. Is, oh, and hatred of Hispanics and homos. Israel first. How will we protect Israel from the Iranian bomb that this deal guarantees them? Mr. Trump asks the idiot who knows nothing. And then what's Trump's response? Oh, the prisoners, they got four people arrested over there, on trial over there, being held over there. And it's not part of the deal that they have to give them up. Well, so what? What does that have to do with a nuclear deal whatsoever? You could add any other pet issue that you want about what Iran is or isn't doing to the nuclear deal in order to spoil it if you want to. Or you could just stick to the nuclear deal. And if what he's really interested in is the faith of the four kidnapped people, not what it looks like to sign a nuclear deal without the four prisoners being in it, then he'd be happy for the deal. Now that we got the nuclear issue out of the way, we can start negotiating with the Iranians on all kinds of stuff, like getting our four guys back. What's so hard about that? Unless, you know, conservatism has your emotions all bubbly and you just can't stand the feeling involved in opening up a new negotiation. What's the big deal there? Nothing. And then he starts to say, giving them back before he stops to talk about himself for a minute. He was going to say, letting them have their money that the Treasury Department, apparently, he was going to say, you know, let them have. I'm sure he would have used the highest estimate anyone ever heard, $150 billion of their own money. It's probably more like $50 billion. But it's their money that the Americans froze, that is, stole. Every crime has a euphemism for it when it's the government doing it, you understand? See if you can rob a bank and say, well, I was just freezing its assets, you know. Giving them back, $50 billion, who cares? What's that? That's chump change. Ask Donald Trump, he'll tell you. That's nothing. And they got a horrible economy they're going to patch up. You're just supposed to believe, as a matter of conservative faith, that they're going to spend every bit of that money arming up Hezbollah just as strongly as they possibly can. Is there any reason to believe that other than faith? No. It's just a nice talking point
the whole reason this guy got elected, Rouhani got elected president, was because he promised, I'm going to deal with the international community, I'm going to get these sanctions lifted, and I'm going to get our economy back to normal again. He doesn't have the mandate to give all their gains away to freaking Hezbollah, nor do they have a policy to arm up Hezbollah to be an army of aggression toward Israel. Nor would it make any sense for them to try. They want to hold on to the Litani River as bad as the Israelis want to steal it, so there's no point in picking a fight that they can't really win. Comes down to it. And then the 24 days, he's got to throw out the 24 days red herring and yesterday, huh? That's funny, because what they said was, come on in. As soon as the Senate failed to defeat the deal, Iran had the IAEA out. We had Gareth Porter on the show yesterday about it, probably right around the same time. This idiot was saying, yeah, they get 24 days before all inspections. No. All of their nuclear facilities are under permanent 24-hour inspection forever. The additional protocol and the subsidiary arrangements to their safeguards agreement last forever. The only place where they get any warning at all is non-nuclear sites, where they're falsely accused by Israeli liars of engaging in one experiment or another, all of which are complete crap, debunked a million times over and over again. Not only by Gareth Porter, but by experts like Robert Kelly, etc. And what's the first thing Iran did? They didn't say, oh, wham, boo-hoo, and drag their feet for 24 days. They said, come on in to Parchin. Come on in and take your samples. Perfectly open to inspection. No test chamber here. No evidence that it was ever moved here or there, because it never existed, because the whole thing's a stupid lie made up in Tel Aviv. Everybody knows that. That's what Mohammed El-Baradei said. He wouldn't even publish it. It took until they got rid of El-Baradei and replaced him with Yuki Amano, who pledged loyalty to America and its agenda. You can read all about it in the WikiLeaks. Thank you, Chelsea Manning. Your sacrifice was worth it for the truth that came out there. Anyway, yeah, it says right there that, oh, yeah, I'll do whatever you say. I'm your humble servant, and never mind the honor of any of my ancestors, et cetera, et cetera. Quote unquote, Yuki Amano. But Baradei wouldn't even put the report out because he thought it was a bunch of crap. Oh, it came from an IAEA member state, huh? Yeah, the Israelis made it up. Bunch of crap. So the whole 24 days point, completely moot already. Completely moot. Self-inspected. No, even the head of the IAEA himself, Yuki Amano, was standing right there. Along with all his buds and the high-definition cameras recording the whole thing. And we'll get the samples back soon, and they'll report no radioactive materials because the whole thing was a stupid lie in the first place. That's not even how you test an implosion system for a nuke anyway. And they didn't have any nuclear scientists involved. They had to make up a Ukrainian nanodiamond scientist who is an expert in implosions, but not in nuclear physics or metallurgy whatsoever. The whole thing was a lie. It's already been debunked for years. 24 days. Give me a break, this idiot. And then he says, no more. They can drag out not just 24 days, but they can just drag it out forever. No. All of their nuclear facilities are under permanent safeguards, and including their mines, and including now even their centrifuge facilities, where there's no nuclear material whatsoever. They've expanded their inspection, their permanent inspections regime. And these... How stupid do you have to be to really think that America just made a deal where nobody gets to inspect anything for months before they announce it? You really are that dumb to let conservative Republicans make you believe, oh, and Israeli liars, public relations experts, make you believe such inanity? Geez, I don't know, Scott. I would have to read past the headline all the way to the second paragraph to figure out what a ridiculous lie this is. And then, this has got to be just... I mean, to me, I don't know. It sort of makes it fun, I guess, in a way. According to Donald Trump, this deal says that if Israel, our greatest ally, goes ahead and attacks Iran and bombs their nuclear program anyway, that America will be bound to ally with Iran in a war against Israel. Really? No. All it says is we have to help them with whatever our guys help them when they're reconfiguring the Iraq reactor, whatever, to keep it safe and secure. There's nothing about a military alliance against Israel, our greatest ally in the whole wide world, in there at all. Again, how stupid would you have to believe that that could possibly be in there? Stupid! Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Eli Clifton and Julian Borger on the show. Interviews. They make the Scott Horton show worthwhile. Yeah. Coming up. Be patient. All right, cool. Oh, there's so many things I forgot to say or hadn't got a chance to say yet. Here's one I forgot to say. Tonight, the future of freedom. That is me interviewing Jacob Hornberger about the things that he writes at liberty.me. That's right, liberty.me. It's like Facebook, but for libertarians. And it's really great, and it's got a bunch of great stuff on there. Like tonight, 8 Eastern time, I will be hosting Jacob Hornberger for the future of freedom. So check that out. I better not forget that. I'm going to write that on my hand right now. Jacob Show. Yeah. Hey, I forget things a lot. I remember things a lot, too. Okay, so there's that. And then the other thing I got to say, oh, here's one of the things I got to say. These are in no particular order, just the order I wrote them down in, which is no particular order. You got to see this, man. Did you see this? Did you know about this? Okay, now listen. This is not just the province of conspiracy nuts. This is just simple economics, see? Because government has a monopoly on being our pretended security service here. And we're not allowed to fire them and replace them with anyone else. They have their incentive structure for providing us security all upside down. Instead of doing a good job so they can keep their job, they need to do a lousy job so that they can keep their job, so that they can expand their power and their influence. So, in other words, you could look at it like this. All the bureaucrats read Bob Higgs, Crisis, and Leviathan, and they said, this guy is right. What we need is an emergency. Always. War's the health of the state. Hooray. That's just how it works. So check it out. This article is in the Washington Post. It's called Obama Faces Growing Momentum to Support Widespread Encryption. And it's about how the cops are pissed off. Now, check this out. Robert S. Litt is the intelligence community's top lawyer. I guess that means whatever his exact job is, they could have named him, but I guess that means he is the top lawyer for the Director of National Intelligence. And he wrote in an email in August that although the legislative environment is very hostile today, it could turn in the event of a terrorist attack or criminal event where strong encryption can be shown to have hindered law enforcement. There is value, he said, in keeping our options open for such a situation. Well, thank you for being so frank in your emails. This is the top lawyer of the intelligence community writing openly in an email about how he would at least partially welcome a terrorist attack against American civilians in order to make us afraid enough to give him power enough to crack every code. Because safety. Because that's his job. It's to fail. You ever see Falling Down about Michael Douglas gets laid off from making nuclear bombs after the Soviets pull the Cold War rug out from under the American arms industry for a minute there? And so he gets laid off and he gets all pissed off. And now he's a government contractor. He knows how this works. And he comes across, he's in L.A., he comes across a bunch of guys shut down the whole damn freeway right at the big spaghetti and meatballs interchange between a bunch of different freeways. They got traffic completely ruined. And he says to them, hey, what's wrong with the road? And they're sputtering and sputtering and they can't admit it. And so he says it for them. There's nothing wrong with the road. Admit it. You just have to destroy the road so that you can rebuild it again. And then they spill their guts. That's the whole deal. In order to make sure to get their budget for next year, they have to make sure to spend everything they got now. So anyway, that's the economics of government. They would see you killed rather than protect you. If it'll make people near you say, oh my goodness, if only the government had had more power, they'd be happy to see you die. Burned to death. Exploded to death. We the people and all that is a big lie. We the people exist to serve the state, according to the state. And that's it. One might have asked Robert Litt, what do you think would be the appropriate number of dead Americans in order to accomplish the mood you're trying to achieve here? And is there such a thing as too many? Maybe we should sacrifice an entire city and throw out the Constitution altogether and have a military form of government, say under Tommy Franks or something like that. David Petraeus. Anyway, Washington Post, read it and weep. And then, yeah, this is along those lines. I really need to get Trevor Tim or one of them geniuses on, Marcy Wheeler, to talk about this. Obama administration quietly explored ways to bypass smartphone encryption. Always trying to crack your security in the name of your security. Don't you love them? And then, by the way, this is worth mentioning, too, about Bo Bergdahl. There's a general who investigated him. His lawyers are trying to get the report released. But the Army officer who conducted the investigation says, apparently he believes Bergdahl's story, and it's not what you've heard from the right-wing media, surprise, surprise. It was that his unit was so undisciplined, and the commanding officers were so, you know, absent or negligent, that things were getting so out of hand, he was trying to trek 10 miles to another base in order to confront a general about it and try to get high-level attention. He was not defecting to the Taliban. He was not trying to walk to China. He was trying to go rat on his bosses to their bosses. And it didn't work out. And so Major General Kenneth Dahl is recommending no prison time. So, was he absent without leave? Yes. Was he any sort of traitor to America or even the U.S. government, his own squad? No. Did anybody die out looking for him? No. They died fighting a stupid-ass war out there near the Durand Line for no reason at all, but not any reason made up by Bergdahl. And as much as this is a story about, you know, this guy, it's a story about American media and how things just never change. They'll never get tired of pumping your head full of hate for whoever. Oh, that Bergdahl. Oh, we're all supposed to be so angry with him. Really? For walking off his job, killing people for a bunch of psychos? A bunch of liars? I don't know. I don't really see the problem. But anyway, the temperature on, you know, the demonization of him will probably never get turned down. Doesn't matter what the facts are. Doesn't matter if the criminal investigators buy his story. Well, look, what happened was I was going to tell the general on the lieutenant. That's all. On the colonel. Whatever the hell. I don't know. Captain. There's another one. Oh, man, I'm never going to get to this if I don't get to it. So let me do it. Where is it? F-35 section. U.S. Air Force requires airmen to praise troubled stealth fighter. In other words, when the camera's on you, you better say you love this plane, boy, or you're in trouble. Sir, yes, sir, we are accepting our orders to lie to the people about this piece of crap plane, sir. Let us drop and give you 20, sir. That one was in War is Boring. This one is General USAF considers measures for F-35 to survive complete mission. They insist, look, the F-35 is great because the plan is it will never ever have to go up against any opposition. Don't be stupid. Yes, it's true that if it ever had to go up against any opposition, that that opposition would kill it to death easily, but don't worry, our job is bombing helpless brown people with no air force in the middle of Central Asia somewhere. I'm not going to actually fight anyone who can fight back, so it's fine. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. Our first guest today is Eli Clifton. And, well, first of all, welcome back to the show, Eli. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you back here. Now, I know recently you've been writing for the Low Blog, but I can't keep track of where all you write, because when I Google you up, you're all over the place. So introduce yourself for us, would you please?
All right. I'm Eli Clifton. I'm a fellow at the Nation Institute, and you're exactly right. The place where most of my work appears, at least in its original publication, is at loblog.com, loblog.com.
Okay, great. And, yeah, of course, that's the great Jim Loeb, and there's tons of great content from all kinds of great writers going back years and years there, the great Jim Loeb. Okay, cool. So, yeah, very happy to know how to introduce you then. Loblog is the most prominent spot you're at right now. However, like I say, people Google you up, they'll find all kinds of stuff, like this thing that you did for the Center for American Progress back a few years ago, which, you know, full disclaimer, that's the Democrats, basically, right? But anyway, still great work, called Fear, Inc. And it's all about not just prejudice or whatever, Islamophobia, but the Islamophobia industry. What is behind and who is bankrolling the movement to make us hate and fear Muslims? And you might as well throw in Arabs, even though most American Arabs are actually Christians and most American Muslims are actually Asians, not Arabs, but whatever. Details and stuff. Point being, we're supposed to hate and fear the enemy within because they're all out to get us. And if you watch the Republican campaign right now, it is just a race to the bottom when it comes to this kind of crap. It's just, it seems like it's gotten so far out of control. Really, since Obama came, people thought that was going to kind of heal all these divides, but really it just put a big partisan emphasis behind, like, where everyone on the right has this partisan motivation to be more racist and more intolerant instead of, you know, if it was a Republican in power, not so much. But anyway, it's like the lid has just been taken off the pot with Obama as the terrorist, Muslim infiltrator, usurper, undermining America and whatever. I mean, this is a big part of the right kind of believes this. And we all kind of feel the spillover from it, you know, and some people, oftentimes Sikhs, get beaten over it and sometimes killed over it, this kind of thing. So I was just sort of hoping, because it seems like it's so important still and again and even more than ever now, to get, you know, just kind of a rundown. Let the audience hear kind of a thumbnail sketch of who and what forces are behind this movement.
Well, you know, I think you really hit on something there with the fact that one would think with 9/11 now receding further and further into the past, that would have been sort of the high point, the high watermark, as it were, for Islamophobia in the United States. But when we started on this report at the Center for American Progress, that was kind of the key assumption that we wanted to tackle, is this idea that, you know, most people completely reasonably assume, well, you know, the hijackers of the planes on 9/11 were Muslims. They were, a lot of them were Saudi. And a fact that frequently gets forgotten, and that would have been the high point for Americans having expressing distrust toward Islam, toward Muslims, and Arabs. The truth is, though, when we looked at the polling numbers, we saw, well, in September 2010, a Washington Post ABC News poll, it found that 49% of Americans held an unfavorable view of Islam. Okay, but in 2002. Only 39% held an unfavorable view of Islam. So that already suggests that something is off. Why did it go up by 10 percentage points over that time period when, in all likelihood, one would think that those numbers should be reversed, should be 49% in 2002 and 39% in 2010? And what we started to look at was, yeah, the amount of money and the amount of time and the amount of bandwidth given to Islamophobes leading up to really the 2008 election. Really, really skyrocketed. We had family foundations putting money in over the 10 years from 2002 to 2010. Family foundations put over $40 million into a number of Islamophobic organizations. They funded misinformation experts like Frank Gaffney at the Center for Security Policy, David Yerushalmi at Society of Americans for National Existence, Daniel Pipes at Middle East Forum, and Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch. And these folks suddenly, around 2008, they broke into the mainstream. They were on Fox News. They were on CNN. They were talking about the Ground Zero Mosque, which was really the Islamic Community Center in Lower Manhattan, which was neither a mosque nor at the site of the World Trade Center. Didn't matter. It was suddenly a controversy. The attempts to paint Obama as a Muslim were a large component of that. Now, the thing that I find surprising now is that in 2012, in the 2012 cycle, it really didn't seem like it was as dominant a narrative. You know, it had sort of played out. It hadn't worked in 2008. Obama had been elected president anyways. There had been this like $16 million project to send this Islamophobic DVD to swing state voters in 2008. Didn't work. And in 2012, we had published this report then, and we really felt like, well, you know, it kind of seems like this has subsided. I'm frankly pretty surprised to see it coming back now. We have Ben Carson saying on Sunday that he wouldn't support a Muslim becoming president. And Carson claims in the past several days that his campaign has raised over $1 million. So it shows that there still is money to be made, and there's still a currency in these bigoted views. That said, as you well put it, it's sort of a race to the bottom in the Republican Party right now. And it would be unfair to characterize the resurgence of Islamophobia as occurring in a vacuum. We're seeing all sorts of hyper-ethnic nationalist type of things being said, and I'm afraid that this sort of has a warm home in places where those types of views are accepted.
Yeah, well, and it's such a great narrative too, where when somebody like Carson says this kind of thing, it's seen on the right as this brave admission of the truth that they'll never say and whatever, but this guy's brave enough to say it, so there's $1 million. And the more opposition that you bring to it, the more persecuted and right they feel that, the cultural Marxists, they're selling us out to the Islamo-fascists and whatever. But meanwhile, and this is the part where even on the left, it hardly ever gets mentioned. People just don't want to talk about this. I'm not exactly sure why, because it's such an easy case to make. I know there's some partisanship to it, but, you know, come on. The basic argument here is that they attacked us on September 11th because we're good and free and white and Christian and Jewish, and they're evil and Muslim, and Islam makes them evil and makes them want to hate and attack good things. But that's a lie. The reason that they hate us is because George H.W. Bush, Jeb's father, occupied the Saudi desert, and Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, kept them there for his entire presidency, bombing Iraq on average every other day, killing people from the bases right near Mecca and Medina, the Holy Peninsula, and they attacked us not on 9/11, but in 93 at the First World Trade Center, at the Khobar Towers, at the African embassies, the USS Cole. They tried to attack LAX in 2000, and all of this not because of Islam, but because of trespassing. Simple as that. That any white Republican, conservative, Christian could understand what happens when you trespass. You get shot. It's just as basically and simple as that. All of this is just cover for what's really going on here. And of course, I left out support for Israel and their occupations of the Lebanese and the Palestinians, which is half the Al-Qaeda argument too. That's what this always was. And I thought that Ron Paul had actually won this argument for honesty in American discourse back in 2007 and 8 when he whooped Rudy Giuliani on this, and yet somehow we're still just supposed to ignore the fact of the existence of the 1990s and all the horrors brought to the people of the Middle East by Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton before Jr. ever even showed up.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly who we're characterizing as they there, but if we want to narrow that down to Al-Qaeda or to ISIS, I think
the people who attacked us. I don't mean Muslims in general. I mean the actual attackers. They said that they did it because of these actual things that the Americans had done, not because Islam makes them hate whoever happens to live between Canada and Mexico.
I think it's important that we recognize that the people who, such as Ben Carson and other Islamophobes who I just mentioned, who are embracing this narrative of Islam being inherently at war with the West, are really throwing in their support for the most radical and violent minority of Muslims and their understanding and description of Islam. When you interpret Islam that way, you are simply saying Al-Qaeda and ISIS are right, that the West and the East and the Christians and the Muslims are inherently going to be in violent conflict. And if you're going to push back against extremism, then you have to reject that and say, well, that is actually not how most Muslims see it. It's not how most Americans see it. It's not how most Westerners see it. It's not how most Christians see it.
Right. What it implies is a total war. I mean, there's 1 billion Muslims in the world. We're going to live with them somehow or not.
Exactly why you would validate the worldview of people who are flying airplanes into buildings is kind of beyond me, and it seems like a very poor national security and foreign policy argument.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I'm sorry for going on so long in the dang discussion, too. But hang on right there, Eli. We've got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with more Eli Clifton from Loblog.com.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commodity discs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, welcome back. Sorry, I went on too long, and you might not have heard all of what Eli was saying as we went into the break there. He was talking about how, you know, this Islamophobia, the narrative behind it, is basically conceding to this fringe enemy of bin Ladenite types that they are the true and legitimate face of Islam, which is exactly what their enemies should not be doing, which is, of course, a very good point there. And now, so I wanted to get back to some of what you reported here in Fear Inc. and some of these other articles. If you just type in Eli Clifton and Islamophobia, you'll find all kinds of different stuff too. At Salon.com, at Low Blog, and of course the big study, Fear Inc. at AmericanProgress.org. But you really break down in here. I mean, you guys really did the great journalism on all this stuff, breaking down exactly, you know, who is bankrolling this Islamophobia business. The most intriguing part of this to me was the story of the model legislation being introduced just to give the impression that it was necessary, which is a very important story. So please do tell.
Right. I mean, this is very much in line with some of the things conducted by ALEC and other right-wing organizations. And basically the model is to create a boilerplate legislation that then you get state representatives to roll out across the country. And this has a couple advantages. And the biggest one really being that a lot of legislation that gets introduced at the state level doesn't get noticed. and that's pretty valuable because sometimes these things can hold a lot of weight. They can have a huge impact. And one of the ways that they can have an impact is that they can, you can then, once you've introduced it 40 or 50 states, you can say, well, clearly this has a lot of support since it's been introduced across the country. In this case, there was legislation introduced that was anti-Sharia legislation, which is something that is really not something that's a threat to the U.S. legal system. At no point has Sharia law really usurped the Constitution or U.S. law or local jurisdictions. This is pretty much entirely fabricated in fiction. But it was rolled out really across the country using boilerplate legislation largely created by David Yerushalmi and advocated by a number of the misinformation experts who we identify. And it was successfully pushed out across the country. Finally, there was actually pushback, believe it or not, in Florida, because Orthodox Jews there recognized that the only instance in which religious law or a private arrangement might, between two consenting parties, might actually be deferred to by a judge is in the case of contract disputes. And they had used Talmudic law and rabbis in some instances in Florida where the parties agree that they're going to abide by this. And when a judge sees it, they say, well, you know, you agreed to these terms, so you have to figure it out through the terms that you've already agreed on, much like sort of how one could tie oneself to a mediation process in a contract. And it was pretty interesting because that was a big showdown over in Florida as far as a lot of us who watch this are concerned. And it ended up being pushed back there because of the fact that this actually would infringe on not just Muslims, but on other religious groups.
Yeah, now that's really important. I didn't know that story, and that's a great point to make. I guess I was also thinking about various Christian groups and their divorce proceedings and child custody.
Exactly.
And this kind of thing, where they have agreements to go along with what their minister decides if they have a dispute or whatever like that. And these are the same people who are the suckers for this demonization of Islam, but it's their customs that are being threatened too.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, it's frequently the fear-mongering often says, well, that this could extend into interfering in, like, criminal proceedings. There's no way that's going to happen. It hasn't happened. You're not going to be successful going and assaulting someone or killing someone and saying that you're going to use your freedom of religion as a defense. You could try it, but, I mean, their track record thus far for people trying that type of thing is that
courts
tend not to look very favorably upon that argument.
Right. And then now, I'm sorry, could you name some of the foundations? You said some family foundations, but then even more interesting than that is the arms manufacturers behind this campaign.
Well, yeah. So the SCAFE Foundations, the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation, which is now more institutional than a family one, the Newton and Rochelle Becker Foundation, the Newton Rochelle Becker Charitable Trust, those are interrelated, and the Russell Berry Foundation and the William Rosenwald Family Fund all played really, they all contributed significant sums of money. In terms of the arms manufacturers, that was something I discovered maybe a little less than a year ago, was that Frank Gaffney, the Center for Security Policy, who actually just recently organized an anti-Iran deal rally where Donald Trump was present in front of the Capitol, and is a big proponent of the conspiracy theory that there's been a Muslim Brotherhood infiltration of the White House. It turned out he was getting $10,000, $20,000 from Boeing and Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, McDonnell Douglas. I have it for 1 year for which I got the documents for. It's possible it occurred in other years as well. But it certainly raises some questions about why somebody who's so far out on the fringe was receiving money from some of the major aerospace manufacturers in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an important point how fringy he is, right? Because Frank Gaffney, former unconfirmed attempted undersecretary of defense back in the Reagan years or something, he is sort of seen as the scum of the neocon movement, right? Like, he doesn't get invited to Thanksgiving with Richard Perle and them. He's sort of a lower down specimen of neocon hack. Am I right about that? They have class distinctions inside the neocon movement.
I mean, I'm not privy to the invite list or Richard Perle's Thanksgiving dinner, and
it does kind of seem like that, though, right? That like you have.
I'd prefer not to even imagine what that looked like, but you know what? Previously, I would have agreed with you, but as of maybe a couple months ago, and seeing groups like Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy and people associated with it being brought more and more toward the Republican foreign policy establishment, for instance, AIPAC promoting signatories to Frank Gaffney's letters in opposition to the Iran deal, I think that maybe the distinctions that existed either were only in our minds or have broken down a bit over as the push against the Iran deal really came together.
I really was just trying to denigrate Gaffney and not elevate Perle, but I understand what you mean. But now, so all of this, and you can see why, because this whole thing, you could call it Operation Conflation. Just, hey, Americans, hate and fear everybody that lives east of Israel and west of India so that at some point we can get around to bombing them. And that's basically what it is.
I think that's for certainly some of these donors and some of these misinformation experts, that probably is a motivating aspect for them.
I mean, especially when you're named some of these, you know, big corporations, Northrop Grumman. I mean, what do they care about anybody's religion or anything else? Their job is simply selling munitions to the U.S. state. That's it. And they need, reasons for the government to need to buy their munitions. Pretty obvious.
It seems like it. And, they certainly would characterize it that way, but I think they certainly actually would agree with the fact that they supported Frank Gaffney because he's been a big advocate of military spending. And we know why Frank Gaffney is a big advocate of military spending.
Right, and what he wants it all spent on. And You know what, too? Here's the thing about this, man. This is destroying America. This is such a big deal. And I think that, obviously there's always been racial problems, and they ebb and flow, and sometimes they're better and sometimes they're worse. But and right now, on one level, PC is completely out of control on everybody's every utterance. But then on the other hand, you have just, seemingly perfectly politically correct bigotry like this. You know, it's not okay to pick on blacks anymore. It's not okay to pick on gay people anymore. But boy, you can pick on Muslims. And, you know, whatever you do, don't pick on the powerful. You got to find somebody, you know, who can't really fight back very much and demonize them. And, you know, it's making the country sick. I don't really believe in that collective unconscious kind of a thing, but as a metaphor, I do. You know what I mean? It's sort of like when Bush said, hey, if you're on the right side of the political spectrum, you got to rally around me and support torture because we did it and we don't want to go to prison. So come on, all conservatives. We love torture, don't we? And the whole right rallied to torture, where before they weren't like that. You know what I mean? Or they were, you know, kind of, but not like that. And so it's just, it's poisoning the whole culture. It's making everybody hate each other more, and for no good reason, all just for corrupt and secret reasons, right? Reasons that are not above board, but like we're talking about, arms sales and, you know, devotion to Israel and this kind of thing.
I would just add, though, in George W. Bush's defense, he spoke out shortly after 9/11 saying that, you know, that America is not at war with Islam and really took this on head on. And it's possible that some of the things he said actually did keep those numbers down in terms of the percentage of Americans who held an unfavorable view of Islam. He's also the only sitting U.S. president to visit a mosque, something that right now I know there's a little bit of pressure, thanks to my good colleague Ali Gharib, who wrote about it in The Nation, trying to encourage that perhaps now's the time for Barack Obama to go visit a mosque after the incident with the high school student who built a clock and was arrested for it. And that, you know, there's an opportunity here. That said, I can also understand why Obama's been cautious to want to avoid the Islamophobia issues, considering all the scrutiny on him. And I'm sure he's questioning whether him speaking out on it would potentially make it worse or make it better, given the amount that he's been a target of so much of this propaganda.
Yeah. Well, that's what Catholic vice presidents are for. You know, get out there, white man, and denounce this bigotry. What the hell? Anyway, thank you so much for doing my show again, Eli. You're great, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that's Eli Clifton, fellow at The Nation, and read him at loblog.com. We'll be right back with Julian Borger in just a sec.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at mastersamuraitech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from mastersamuraitech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at mastersamuraitech.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Here live noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Next up today is Julian Borger, writer of important journalism at The Guardian. This one is called West Ignored Russian Offer in 2012 to Have Syria's Assad Step Aside. And that part of the headline is in quotes, too. Welcome to the show, Julian. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate you joining us today. Been reading you for years and years. I'm finally glad I finally have an opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you.
What a story here. Say it ain't so, please.
Well, it's not me saying it is so. It's Martti Ahtisaari, who is a former Finnish president and a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for former efforts towards brokering peace in conflicts around the world. So what he says, you know, does carry a certain amount of weight. And what he is saying is that back in February 2012, the Russian ambassador to the UN put to him a proposal that involved Assad stepping aside as part of a peace deal, as he described it, in a elegant manner. And his claim, Ahtisaari's claim, is that the other members of the Security Council, that the Western so-called P3, didn't seem to be interested because they thought, like many people thought at the time, that Assad's days were numbered, and he was about to fall. So that, in a nutshell, is what Ahtisaari is claiming.
Mm. All right, now, at least one source in your story, I think, tries to diminish it and say, nah, come on, if that had happened, I would have followed up and made sure that it was serious, and I would have made sure that, you know, it wasn't just some kind of double bluff by Putin, some kind of thing like that. So what makes you so confident that the offer was as serious as he portrays it?
Well, we don't know that. Ahtisaari doesn't know that. What he's saying is that the offer wasn't even explored, that they didn't even make the effort because of this certainty that there was at the time that Assad was on the way down. So he's saying, you know, maybe it would have not led to anything, but it should have, because it was an opportunity, it was an opening. And now when we look back on it 3 years later, it's a missed opportunity. Mm.
And not sorry, he obviously thinks it was somewhat serious. He takes it serious on some level. This wasn't just, talk over coffee in the break room or something here. This was a real offer on some level anyway. Correct? I'm reading that right. Lost internet connection. I knew it was a bad question, but was it that bad? Did we get you back there? Nope. Bandwidth problems. I mean, according to Skype. Hope that's not anybody's intelligence service interfering with my radio show. That would, be a pet peeve of mine. I guess probably not. We should be paranoid, but not completely paranoid. Agreed? All right. Well, I'm waiting for Skype. There we go. Can we hear you now? Julian, are you there? Nope. Skype. Oh, Skype. Let's see. We got a backup number for Borger here. Oh, Julian, can you hear me? Can I hear you?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Yeah, a bit of a bandwidth problem. I'm sorry. I was just saying, apparently he took this seriously enough that, he's talking about it. Now, it wasn't just idle chatter anyway from Vitaly Churchkin, the Russian ambassador here.
No, I clearly, I take him, Artazari, at his word that this conversation happened. Churchkin, when we asked him about it, said it was a private conversation and he didn't want to comment on it. I have every reason to believe that the conversation did take place. Mm-hmm. And there is no reason to believe that Churchkin was freelancing. It seems more than likely that he had authority from the top in Moscow to float this idea. But there is a question of to what extent it was serious. I mean, the part of the deal was you in the West and in the Gulf cut off all support and supply of arms to the opposition. Then the opposition will have a dialogue with the regime, and as part of that peace deal that comes out of that, at some point in the future, Assad will step down. And it's quite easy how to see how, looking from a Western perspective, that may have looked like a trap at the time. You cut off support to the opposition, and then later down the line, Assad might step down. And certainly, we're talking to people since writing the article, that seems to have been the view from the West, that this was a trap. And when they tried to check it with Moscow, everything seemed a bit hazy and flaky. Artazari's argument is, maybe it was flaky, maybe it was hazy, but as diplomats, we are supposed to explore every avenue when it comes to try and bring peace in a very bloody war, and any opportunity, no matter how slim it seems then and now, should have been explored.
Yeah, I'm not buying the whole probably a trap or could have been a trap thing. Anyway, it doesn't sound like it to me. It sounds like a pretty good faith offer. Again, like you said, not freelancing. I mean, this is a pretty serious thing for a Russian ambassador to bring up. It must have been at Putin's behest, and he's not one to clown around and bluff too much. It doesn't seem like, whatever you think of him. It's funny because when we talk about this now, I'm looking at this article. I've been talking about this article for a week straight here on the show. It's driving me crazy how we're not just talking about 2012 here. We're talking February 2012. We're talking the very beginning of 2012, which is so long ago and so early on into this horrible conflict that's raged ever since then, with just countless people, killed and maimed and displaced, and just the horror that has taken place since then. But on the other hand, this is a full 6 months after Obama said Assad must step aside, and he didn't, and it didn't work. And I'm sure if we check the archives, you can find conversations of me speaking with Patrick Coburn and Pepe Escobar and others at the time, pointing out that Assad's not going anywhere. Assad has every ethnic and religious minority, plus a good chunk, if not the majority of the Sunnis, on his side. And so it would take a real war by the West to get rid of him. It's not going to be like Libya. It's not a simple east to west march with NATO air support like in Libya. It's a whole different thing, much more complicated, not that easy. And yet, but Obama and them were so confident, even 6 months after saying he must leave and he hadn't left yet, that he's still going to fall any day now. I mean, this is just, I sound like a Republican accusing Obama of this level of incompetence.
Yeah, there's another element to this, and that is by February 2012, Assad's forces had already been responsible for many massacres and for crimes against humanity. Since then, they've been responsible for a whole lot more, the kind of blanket barrel bombing of cities. And by comparison, the death toll back then was over 7,000. But it did, you know, look, you know, he was clearly, his regime was clearly responsible for terrible war crimes. And so the dilemma to some extent is, do you make peace with someone like this? Or do you try, you know, do you refuse to have anything to do with them and because of what they're responsible for? And this issue came up before with Slobodan Milosevic. And in the Balkans, the solution was make peace with them and then go after him for war crimes, crimes against humanity. Sometimes you have to hold your nose and do business.
All right. Now hold it right there, please. We'll be right back, everybody, after this break with more with Julian Borger from The Guardian. Guardian on his important piece, West Ignored Russian Offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Julian Borger, reporter for The Guardian here. Writes a lot of important stuff. This one is called West Ignored Russian Offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside. The source being the former president of Finland, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahtisaari. The Russians had floated the idea, Borger reports here, back at the beginning of 2012, that that Assad stepping aside could be negotiated. Quite possibly this war could have been averted. And then, as you say in the piece here, Julian, at the time that this happened, the death toll was estimated to be around 7,500 dead, and that death toll is now believed to be almost, you know, 220,000. You say so? Yeah, a lot of time has passed. A lot of blood has been spilt since this. Possible. I mean, there's no real counterfactual here, but sounds like a real good opportunity that they could have taken up. And right around that same time, they kept trying to put together these governments in exile in Qatar and that kind of thing. Hillary Clinton was doing that. And yet they kept all declaring their allegiance to the al-Nusra Front right away, because it was their only stab at credibility, was to try to associate themselves with the guys who were actually doing the fighting on the ground. So that just kept falling apart, because there was kind of nobody to negotiate with other than, I guess, the foreign patrons and sponsors of these Islamist groups. Is that basically the deal?
Yeah, I mean, the long history of Western and U.S. and allied attempts to build this long hoped for so-called moderate opposition has been a bit of a fiasco. There have been all sorts of problems, trying to define who is moderate, who is Islamist, and the nervousness about giving weapons for that reason, because they weren't sure who they were dealing with, and they were nervous about the ending up in the hands of terrorist groups. They were nervous about giving guns. So the people they were backing didn't really have much to show for Western support. They didn't have any guns. The people with the guns were getting their support from the Gulf, from the people in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, and so on. They were the ones with the guns. They were the ones winning the battle, and then they were the ones drawing the recruits. So, you know, in a way, by being half-hearted about it because, you know, of the uncertainties about the project, it meant that the people they were backing were weakened against the competition, the al-Nusra, and eventually ISIL, Islamic State. So the whole venture was flawed from the very beginning, and has been a disaster. And in the last few weeks, American general head of the Central Command, General Austin, is saying that actually there were only 4 or 5 U.S.-backed fighters in the fight inside Syria, which is incredible.
Well, of the DOD-trained ones, right, he was omitting the CIA and their separate project.
You know, by all accounts, whether CIA, whether DOD, whether Western-backed at all, it doesn't add up to a whole lot. In terms of, you know, a force on the ground.
The CIA guys, they defected to al-Nusra years ago. Anyway.
You know, we don't know, you know, and, you know, part of the kind of the fact that I think that the CIA could see, in their future headlines about CIA trained rebels ending up fighting with, you know, terrorist groups meant that the whole effort was very, very tepid, very cautious. And ultimately, partly for that reason, completely unsuccessful.
Well, yeah, or at least compared to how bad it could have been, and it could have just been much worse and not necessarily successful at all, or succeeding in overthrowing the Ba'ath government and its army could have succeeded in getting, you know, creating that many million more refugees, that many more people killed for refusing to convert, and this kind of thing. Crucified at the hands of the bin Ladenites. So depends on whose definition of worse, you know?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, I think a stronger Western involvement, you know, maybe, you know, if they were able to stop barrel bombing, which is, you know, one of the leading, you know, cause of death among civilians is being barrel bombed by the regime. But if you step in, try and stop that, you know, what are all the unintended consequences? Well, one thing is for sure that the killing will go on, and, you know, it'll be seen much more as your fault if you get involved. So, you know, these are the dilemmas facing the Obama administration. Ultimately, they've chosen to deal with it, you know, at one stepping back. And not dealing with, not getting involved like Libya, obviously not like Iraq. But either way, you know, there's a heavy price to pay.
Yeah. All right, now, so it seems possibly that the same kind of thing is happening again here with a couple of Russian trial balloons lately. This one in Reuters, Russia says Syria's Assad ready to share power. I think there was one that was, I don't know the exact Russian translation, but something along the lines of, you know, with him stepping down at the end of negotiations, and I guess the American position is no, he has to step down before any negotiations start. But do you think that these Russian trial balloons are serious, and do you think the Americans are likely to soften their position at all and actually maybe try to begin to negotiate an end to this thing short of regime change?
Yeah,
I mean, Russians are there now, so they got to give up on regime change now, because what are they going to do? The Russians got army on the ground, right?
Right. You know, it threatens to be a quagmire for the Russians. You know, you start going in, putting in an airfield, you've got to defend that airfield, and then what if you're people are attacked, you're gonna double down, send people in. So, you know, the Russians are looking, you know, at some significant risks here in Syria. It seems to me that the West, US allies, are now, you know, would definitely gratefully take that deal. Our UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond put forward a proposal that that Assad could stay on the head of a transitional government, but that was completely rejected in Damascus. And the question now, of course, is, and maybe the question always has been, you know, the Assad regime in Damascus has two protectors. It has Russia, but it also has Iran. What is now Iran is kind of more at the table since the nuclear deal. It's definitely a factor. It definitely has a big say. Its presence, its military presence there, much stronger than the Russians. So it is a player. What, you know, and so far we've seen not much give from the Iranians, certainly not from the Revolutionary Guard, in terms of, you know, being able to sort of putting Assad's future on the table. So there, you know, there are a lot of moving parts. Maybe they'll get somewhere in this coming General Assembly high-level meeting next week. Putin will be in town in New York. Rouhani will be in town. There will be a meeting on Syria. There'll be bilaterals between Obama and Putin. Rouhani may meet Obama. We don't know yet. But there is at least, you know, room for some of the big power brokers behind the scenes in Syria to get together next week in New York. And you've got to hope that they take that opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And now, so as far as the situation on the ground right now, you mentioned the presence of the Iranians and obviously Hezbollah is helping out a little bit. But this current Russian intervention, it's, I guess, sort of being taken at face value that the Russians are intervening as much as they are needed to intervene. In other words, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing if Assad wasn't really, you know, with his back up against the wall now. And I guess Patrick Coburn was reporting about the last major highway was under threat now, this kind of thing. And I wonder if you think it's just as simple as that. Russia's doing what they're doing now because otherwise Assad could be toast.
I think so. I think, you know, they are protecting their investment. Their investment in the Syrian regime is to have a foothold in the Mediterranean at Tartus, Latakia, and Tartus. And if Assad is looking shaky again, as he was back in 2012, they have to think about protecting that investment. If he falls, they would at least have facts on the ground. They would have their enclave, and they'd be ready to defend it in the, you know, the horse trading and probably the combat that would follow. So that is definitely one perspective which you can see the Russian intervention.
All right, so that is Julian Borger reporting for The Guardian. Thanks very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right, y'all. It's West ignored Russian offer in 2012 to have Syria's Assad step aside. Read it and weep. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks.